So, welcome to the lecture 4 of optical spectroscopy course. And the first topic of today is FTIR spectrometer and the theory of FTIR. So this is fairly common instrument in optical spectroscopy used for measuring infrared spectra. And because the principle, working principle is very different from a normal spectrometer, absorption spectrometer, it is maybe a good idea to go through a little bit of the principle of the technique. So we start by talking about Fourier transformation and interferometers. So the FTIR is an interferometer. And the key point here is that it is not a dispersive instrument in a sense that one would choose one wavelength at a time and measure absorption at different wavelengths. But in FTIR spectrometer, all the wavelengths are basically measured simultaneously. And how this works is explained by the principle of Fourier transform. And so we are going to explain this by starting with considering a monochromatic radiation signal in time domain. And we can represent this signal with this expression. So basically, we have a function f, which is a function of time. So we are interested in the amplitude of the function f as a function of time. And this can be given as an oscillating cosine function with frequency nu. And we have argument t also here because we have time, and A is the amplitude. So this is a general representation of oscillating function. And this is how it looks like. So this, of course, is this could represent a radiation, electromagnetic radiation with the frequency nu. And the upper part of the figure here shows how this signal looks in time domain. So the x-axis is now time. And this is, of course, a periodically oscillating function. Now, when we do the mathematical process of a Fourier transform, we convert this function from time domain to frequency domain. And these are the two domains we have. We have frequency and time. And this is a representation of this function in time domain. And if we do a Fourier transform, we represent this function in frequency domain. And this kind of function looks like this in frequency domain. There is a one sharp peak at the frequency nu. And this makes sense because we know that we have an oscillatory monochromatic function. Then that corresponds to one single frequency in frequency domain. Now, let's consider a bit more complicated case. So now let's say that we are emitting two frequencies. And we can represent this function with this kind of expression. So now we have function ft, and that is a sum of two cosine functions. And now they both have the same amplitude, but the frequency is different. So the first function has a frequency of nu, and the second one has a frequency of 1/4 of nu. Okay, so now if we plot this function in time domain, it looks like this. So now, because we have two different frequencies, we see this kind of a beating signal, and it looks a bit more complicated than just a single monochromatic wave. And now if we perform Fourier transform operation, we again convert this function from time domain into frequency domain. And as you can guess, what we will see is two peaks with equal amplitude, but the first peak has 1/4 of frequency from the upper peak. So this we can now, we can understand that, that this makes sense that we get two peaks, and it is indeed a mathematical operation of Fourier transform, which gives me conversion from time domain into frequency domain. And in fact, you can do also the opposite operation. You can go from frequency to time domain. So we see that these two are actually just representations of the same function in two different domains. Now, let's have one more example. So now we have two frequencies again, but amplitudes are different. So here we have again cosine function with nu, frequency nu, and amplitude a per 2 plus cosine 1/4 of nu and amplitude a. And that looks like this in time domain. And when we perform Fourier transform, it gives us this kind of function in frequency domain, and it represents what we already learned from here, that the lower frequency peak has a higher amplitude, amplitude A, and the higher frequency peak with the frequency nu has half A amplitude. So these examples show you how this Fourier transform works to represent the same function either in time or frequency domain. Now, so these are simple examples from of discrete frequencies. We have two discrete frequencies, but in general, of course, we can have many, many frequencies present. And in this case, either we can represent this as a sum of many, many cosine functions, or if we have a essentially a continuous distribution of frequencies like we can have in, for example, in a broadband light source, then we can represent this as an integral. And now the integral is taken from oscillatory functions, which we now represent with this exponential function. So basically e to I 2 pi nu t is also an oscillatory function, as we remember from the Euler formula. So, and so now this basically is our oscillatory part, a nuclear frequency nu, and this is gives the amplitude at that particular frequency. And now this is a continuous function, and then instead of summing discrete frequency functions, we integrate over all possible frequencies. And then this representation applies to any situation. For example, for a continuous distribution of frequencies, and that shows us the function in time domain is given by this expression. Now we can see that here we have this is basically a spectrum. So the function in frequency domain. So it's amplitude as a function of frequency. And when we multiply that with exponential function like this and integrate, we get the spectrum in time domain. So this kind of representation. But if we do the other way around, so if we take this spectrum or representation in time domain and multiply with exponential function, now with the minus imaginary component, this is just a detail, then integrate, we get the spectrum in frequency domain. So this is exactly same thing what we did or with what was happening in these simple examples, but now with the continuous distribution of frequencies. And we call this to this pair of relations as a Fourier transform pair. So we see that a spectrum in frequency domain corresponds to a function in time domain. And we can measure our spectrum in either domain, and we get the other one from the other one by Fourier transform. Okay, like we did in these simple examples. So this Fourier transform, we are not going to practice how it is done, but for simple cases, you can perform this a mathematical operation by yourself, but in practice, it is carried out by a computer. So this is a computer algorithm which performs Fourier transformation. So you can have a function and you can perform Fourier transformation with a computer. So now this already tells us that often we are interested in this. So this is our spectrum in frequency domain. And of course, with the normal spectrometer, we measure this directly. But now this is already hinting that if we measure this function, so function in time domain, if for some reason that is somehow more simple or convenient, then we can obtain the spectrum from this function. And next we are going to learn how this works. But first, certainly if we are going to measure this FT function, then we have to finish our measurement at some point, or perhaps the function itself is not going to stay forever at the same amplitude, but there is certain lifetime for the function, and then the amplitude will decay in time. And what that does is that creates width to our frequency domain spectrum. And they are related. So the lifetime in time domain, so basically how fast the amplitude decays, is proportional to the width of our spectral lines in frequency domain. This is something that we already encountered earlier at the lecture, and we explained this with the type of uncertainty principle, that the lifetime is a kind of source of uncertainty in time. So tau is the lifetime here, times delta E, so that this uncertainty in energy is larger or equal to h bar. And now if we divide by tau, we get h bar per tau, and the uncertainty in energy is equal to h bar per tau. And we can, as we remember, that the frequency nu is related to energy by factor of h. So E is h nu, and then we divide by h, and we can convert this to delta nu, which is a width in frequency domain. And that is equal to this expression, 1 over 2 pi tau. So that shows that the tau, the lifetime or the decay time of the function in time domain, corresponds to creation of width in frequency domain. So if this decays very fast, we will get very broad bands or lines in the frequency domain and vice versa. Okay, so now if we think that this frequency domain spectrum is basically the electromagnetic spectrum, which we know consists of rapidly oscillating electric field. So that tells us that if we would measure this oscillation of electric field directly in time, that would give us the FT function, and then we would get the spectrum by Fourier transform. But for optical frequency range, the oscillation frequency is way too high to be measured directly. We don't have so fast detectors that we can put the detector and measure the oscillation frequency directly. So that is not feasible. But we can circumvent this with a special technique of interferometry. And interferometry is a method by which we can capture the waveform without measuring directly the time domain signal. So let's see how that works. So here we use a so-called Michelson interferometer. And this equipment or instrument looks like this. It consists of two mirrors, a beam splitter, and a detector. And beam splitter is an optical element which passes part of the radiation and reflects part of the radiation. Ideally, it reflects 50% and passes 50%. So it's like a Bohr mirror, if you like. And I will go here. Yes. So this is the same system, but now with a different picture. And the idea is the following. So one of the mirrors is stationary, so that is fixed. And the beam splitter is fixed. But the other mirror is movable, so we can move it. And now we take our light source and radiate or irradiate, make a beam of light, and that hits the beam splitter. So 50% is reflected, and then it's reflected back from the stationary mirror. 50% goes through, and then it's reflected back on the beam splitter. And now this wave and this wave that is reflected back, of course, 50% will be transmitted. And then this transmitted wave and this reflected wave are combined, and it goes to the detector. And now the point is that even though we don't see it by eye, but we have this wave in space. And now when we have the beam splitter, if the distance between stationary mirror and a beam splitter and movable mirror and beam splitter is exactly the same, then the phase is at the same. Phases are the same for the two waves, and then they combine constructively. And we see a certain intensity here at the detector. But now when we move, if we move half a wavelength, then this wave will be half a wavelength out of phase with this one, and they combine destructively. And we see a minimum in the intensity. And when we move this mirror back this way, we will observe here oscillating, basically periodically oscillating intensity. And that, then we can relate this position of the mirror to wavelength. So we can track basically how the wave is in space here. So of course, if we take a monochromatic light beam, which has only one single wavelength corresponding a certain frequency, then moving this mirror will generate oscillatory function. Now, if we have a distribution of frequencies, all the waves will interfere in a similar way. And depending on the wavelength or frequency, some of them go in phase, out of phase, and we have a more complicated pattern. But we can basically then correlate the distance here, basically the distance with the signal, overall signal, and that gives us so kind of an interferogram, which is related to the wavelength, and the wavelengths are related to frequencies. So we can basically convert this motion in space to time domain. And now it works in this way. So instead of signal in time domain, as we had previously, FT, now we have a signal intensity in delta domain, which is now the path difference. So basically spatial domain, path difference. And that is given by this expression here. And here we have amplitude. Now this is a new bar, so the wave number. It doesn't matter. It can be frequency or wave number. And cosine function with this wave number, new bar. So this is exactly analogous expression as what we had before for the time domain signal, but now it is a spatial domain signal, so the path difference. And we just have a oscillatory cosine functions with the wave number nu bar, with amplitude nu bar, we integrate over nu bar, and now instead of time, we have path difference. Okay, now this is still from zero to infinity, but if we assume that this is symmetrical signal, then we can write this in this way. So we have an integral from minus infinity to infinity, and then otherwise the same. And then it appears that this can be written also in this way with the exponential function. And now we recognize that this is exactly same form as we had previously for the Fourier transform pair. So that means that now we have a Fourier transform pair between the spectrum, so basically signal in wave number domain. This could be also frequency domain. And we have the intensity in path or spatial domain or path difference domain. And now, so this means that we can obtain the spectrum from the intensity in path difference domain via Fourier transform. And now this tells us that if we measure this, which is now actually doable, we just have to have an interferometer, single detector, and broad a light source, and we can actually measure this. And when we measure this, we can obtain the spectrum from here by Fourier transformation. And this is how FTIR works. So this the broadband source in length domain or path difference domain is called interferogram. So when we have a zero path difference, all the waves, all the frequency components are in the same phase, and we see a maximum signal. And out of this domain, when we start to go to higher or smaller path difference, some of the waves interfere destructively and the signal decays. And this is how it looks. So this is an interferogram. So let me recap what it is. Here we have measured with a single detector intensity of light coming through the interferometer as a function of path difference between two mirrors. And here is the zero path difference. Here, the path is the same, so we get maximum signal. And then we start moving the mirror to longer distance, so signal decays and it oscillates and finally decays. And this is symmetrical in ideal case. So this is what is the primary measurement or how the primary measurement looks like in an FTIR. And then we just let the computer make a Fourier transform to the signal, and this is what we get. And this is the spectrum. This is now the wave number domain. And this is how typically our signal looks like. So this is a light source, overall intensity with some kind of characteristic emission of radiation, and then we have here we have many lines and absorptions, and I can recognize that these come from water vapor and from carbon dioxide. So this is how FTIR works, and then the actual measurement is performed so that if we have a sample, we first measure the interferogram without the sample and obtain this kind of single beam spectrum. And then we put the measurement and put the sample on and measure again. And we get the somewhat similar but slightly different interferogram. And then we take the ratio and minus logarithm, and that gives us the absorbance spectrum. So then the point is that from the light source, we let all the frequencies or wave number radiation elements pass simultaneously through the sample, and we run the interferogram, drive the interferometer in space, and obtain the Fourier transform, and then obtain the interferogram, which then can be converted to spectrum via Fourier transform. So as you can see, this is a very different kind of method than measuring spectrum directly in frequency domain, for example, by using a dispersive element, which disperses light and the detector. And it turns out that this technique has certain advantages compared to the dispersive technique, which are for the infrared range remarkable. And that's why we all the infrared spectrometers nowadays, that they work on this principle. So it is much better than dispersive spectrometer. All right. The last thing is that the resolution of the instrument. So basically, how sharp lines we can see in the spectrum depends on the maximum optical path difference. So that is, how long do we drive the movable mirror? That determines the resolution. So if we move only short distance, resolution is poor. But if we drive it to long distance, then we get better resolution, and the highest resolution FTIR spectrometers have a path length of many meters for the movable mirror. Okay, so now we change the topic quite totally, and we go to light scattering. And this comes from Kelly book, chapter 10. And why we do this is that we are very, very much concentrating on Raman techniques on this course. And Raman spectroscopy is based on light scattering. So we want to understand a bit more that the principles of light scattering from the theoretical point of view, so that we can understand this Raman techniques better. But there are, it's also important to distinguish different kind of light scattering mechanisms. And we start by not Raman scattering, but a scattering from particles, just to introduce you to this light scattering. So basically, what we mean by light scattering is interaction of electromagnetic field with any sample. And this interaction produces a secondary or different electromagnetic field. And that may differ from the incident one by frequency, direction, and the polarization. And now, when we understand these different changes there, we can obtain information on the sample. Now, it's important to understand that the scattering phenomenon is extremely fast. So it occurs on ultra-fast timescale in a few femtoseconds. And it is not should not be considered as absorption emission process, but rather coherent process where the material system responds coherently to electromagnetic wave, and there is no dephasing or relaxation processes in between. So the electromagnetic wave induces polarization in the matter or molecule, and that radiates scattered wave without any relaxation processes in between. But still, in the photon picture, we can consider this as two photon processes, in a sense that we have incident photon, and then we have a scattered photon, and we destroy the incident photon and create a second scattered photon. Okay, but let's start from scattering from particles, and more accurately, Rayleigh scattering. So what does it mean? So Rayleigh scattering is so-called elastic scattering, which means that a frequency does not change in Rayleigh scattering. So the scattered wave or scattered photon has the same frequency as the incident frequency. And now the particles can be something like nanoparticles or something equivalent. And here we should be limited to particles that are much smaller than wavelengths. So we are talking about, for visible radiation, particles with maybe 100, 200 nanometers or less, from few nanometers up to few hundred nanometers, that size of particles. And we can start considering this by this model. So we have a sample, and we have incident radiation, and we have a transmitted radiation. And scattering means that radiation is scattered to all directions in the sample. And that means that that will reduce the transmitted radiation through the sample. And we can have two processes. We can have scattering, but also absorption, and both reduce the intensity of transmitted light. And altogether, for these two processes, we talk about extinction. So if any attenuation of PI occurs, then we talk about extinction. And it can happen via absorption or scattering. And we can consider this situation with the rate at which energy is removed from the sample. So, of course, this radiation can be considered as energy flux, flux of photons. So certain flux is propagating, and we can say that a certain number of joules per second is propagating, and then via scattering and absorption, energy is removed from the sample and with a certain rate. And now let this rate be marked by W, and we can say that extinction rate of extinction is equal to rate of absorption plus rate of scattering. Now if we divide this rate by intensity, initial intensity, then we yield cross-section. So for example, extinction cross-section is extinction, the rate divided by intensity, and that is the extinction cross-section. Same for the scattering cross-section, and same for the absorption cross-section. So if we can measure these individually, then we can determine this both individually, then we can determine extinction altogether, or we can just determine the extinction in the first place. So the extinction cross-section is equal to sum of absorption cross-section and scattering cross-section. Okay, so now we start modeling the situation theoretically, and then we make assumptions. So we first assume that the particle is large enough and homogeneous so that it can be considered as homogeneous bulk matter, a piece of homogeneous bulk matter. And in this situation, we don't care about atomistic details, and we just consider this as a matter which can be simply described with dielectric function. So basically, dielectric constant, but it's not actually constant, but it depends on frequency, and that's why we call it dielectric function. And that depends on the electronic structure of the matter. So it's basically this single function captures all the electronic structure that the matter has. But this is something that can be measured, and this is something you can find from the literature for various materials. Okay, and this also means that we are considering a classical model. So, and now as a second assumption, we consider these particles to be spheres, and these spheres are immersed in a medium, homogeneous medium, which also can be described with dielectric function, and let it be epsilon. This is epsilon one. Now, if this is a gas or air or something like that, we can consider this to be one. Otherwise, it can be also liquid, and then we have to consider the dielectric function of the liquid, for example. And final assumption is that we assume collimated beam, or that means parallel beam. So not diverting, but the parallel beam, like a laser beam. And frequency, it has a frequency omega zero, and that is incident on a sample. And then under these assumptions and these conditions, what will happen is that this oscillating electric field will induce oscillating dipole in the sphere. And that oscillating dipole in a classical theory is then source of electromagnetic radiation. And that oscillating dipole will generate secondary radiation, and that is our scattering. And this is the model that we have. Now you can model this system strictly by solving Maxwell's equations. This is something that we are not doing, but we just look at the result. So the result looks like this. It turns out that we can, under these assumptions, we can calculate the scattering cross-section theoretically. And that is very nice. So now we calculate the scattering cross-section at the frequency omega zero. Remember, this was the incident frequency. Okay? And this is what we get. Looks quite simple. We have constants and k is a wave vector. Remember, k is 2 pi n per lambda, where n is refractive index. So this is proportional to the wavelength of light. So, and you immediately see that we have a dependence on wavelength as a inverse fourth power. So wavelength will be here, and it is a fourth power. And then we have this factor here, which is explained on the next page. So that is so-called polarizability volume of the sphere. So that describes how easily our material is polarized. And it is given by this expression here. And you can see that we have A, which is the radius of the particle. So basically, this gives us the dependence of the polarizability from the on the size of the particle. And if you remember here, it was square of this function. And here we have the third power. So it means that it is a sixth power of the radius. So it's quite strong dependence on the size of the particle. And the rest is just the two dielectric functions, E1 omega minus E omega divided by E1 omega plus 2E epsilon omega, sorry, epsilon omega. So if we know these functions or the values of these functions at frequency omega, we can calculate the polarizability volume, and then we can calculate the scattering cross section. So this is very neat. So now we can actually calculate the scattering cross section just from the dielectric function of the particle material and the medium. And this is something we can find from the literature or tables. And there is one demo exercise on this for you. So really this scattering cross section scales a sixth power of the particle radius. So when the particle size increases, we increase very rapidly the scattering. And inverse fourth power of wavelength. And here is this question that we already encountered on the first lecture, that why sky is blue. This is somehow related to this factor here. So this tells us that how the scattering efficiency depends on the wavelength of light. Okay, so so this this particle scattering, which is also called Mie scattering, then is a mechanism by which light is scattered and from particles. And as an example, you can consider milk. So you see that the milk is white. And that means that the white color comes from the scattering. So the white light around you scatters very strongly from the milk. And it is because in the milk there is water, but there are small droplets of fat and maybe also proteins. But these droplets can be considered as particles in a scattering sense, and then light is scattered from these particles or droplets, and that's why milk is white. Okay, so now we go to different kind of scattering, and that is molecular Rayleigh and Raman scattering. So now we consider materials like gas or liquid or solid, so no particles anymore, but a homogeneous material, and the essential unit from which scattering occurs is a molecule. So that's why we call this molecular Rayleigh or Raman. And now we have two kinds of scattering, Rayleigh and Raman. And as I explained, Rayleigh scattering is elastic scattering, where the frequency of scattered light is the same as incident light. So there is no exchange of energy between radiation and matter. But Raman scattering is inelastic scattering, and there the scattered light has different frequency from incident light, and that means that there has occurred energy exchange between radiation and matter. And on this lecture we are going to go through classical treatment of these scattering processes. And in fact, it is quite neat theory. It explains a big part of Raman scattering and Rayleigh scattering in a very elegant way. And that's why we start from there. The quantum theory is much more complicated, but it certainly is needed then for more advanced treatment. But the classical model explains very nicely the phenomenon itself. Okay, so now we start with a bit similar model as for the particles. So, but now instead of a particle, we consider a molecule. So molecule also has polarizability. Can be considered an object which can be polarized, and it has a polarizability alpha. That means that when you put the molecule into electric field, this electric field will affect the electron or the charge distribution of your molecule, and it will induce a dipole moment. And the larger the polarizability, the larger the induced dipole moment will be. So that kind of describes kind of how loose is your electron density or cloud in the molecule. But now, of course, now we consider time-varying electric field of, so this is the electric field of our electromagnetic radiation, and then that will induce a time-dependent dipole, induced dipole moment. And we describe this with the mu t function. So mu is a symbol for dipole moment, and then t means that it is a time-dependent dipole moment. And we can write simply this way that the time-dependent dipole moment is equal to electric field, time-dependent electric field, times polarizability. Okay. Now, so this would, if we have only this would tell us that if we have a certain frequency of E, it will induce the same frequency of oscillating dipole, and that creates secondary radiation, and then that would account for the Rayleigh scattering. But now we have a second effect in place, namely, when the molecule vibrates, the geometry of your molecule changes. And when the geometry changes, the polarizability also changes. So that means that your polarizability will be time dependent. Okay. So now let's consider how we can describe this. So let's consider just the one single vibrational coordinate. So this could be considered like a diatomic molecule with one vibration and a small amplitude vibration. And now the question is, how do we mathematically describe this time dependence of this polarizability? And we could have a complicated function, but we use this kind of expression. So polarizability, let it be kind of a constant polarizability plus derivative of the polarizability with respect to coordinate q times the coordinate. And what this is this is a two first terms of the Taylor expanse. So that tells us how the polarizability changes along with the vibrational coordinate q. Okay. So by using this simple expression, we can describe the dependence on the vibrational coordinate without having to use some kind of a complicated function. Okay. Now we can put in the how Q varies in time. And of course, a simple formula, simple model is a harmonic oscillator, classical harmonic oscillator. And then we can give Q in this expression. So it's a Q0, that is the amplitude of your coordinate, times cosine, oscillatory cosine function. So this is a harmonic oscillator. It has a frequency omega v, so vibrational frequency, this is angular frequency, times t plus delta. And this is a phase factor. So that is for completeness, we have the phase, but we can put it to zero so that we can drop it. It has no significance in this derivation. So what we have done now is that we have described the time dependence of the vibrational coordinate, and now we plug it into the polarizability, and that gives us the expression for the time-dependent polarizability along with the vibration. Okay, and then we have then the time dependence of electric field, and now we can do it in this simple way, just a cosine function with the frequency omega, and again we can drop the phase factor there. So then we have the electric field amplitude and then the cosine term for the electric field. And now, if I go back a bit, you remember that we are interested in expression for this time-dependent dipole moment. And now we are going to plug in the alpha, which we get from here. And there we plug in the q, time dependence for the q. So we will have time dependent oscillatory polarizability. And now we plug in also the electric field time dependence from a cosine function. So we have a two time dependent cosine functions and product of them. So when we do this, we get expression for the induced time-dependent dipole moment. And it looks like this. So we have an electric field amplitude. We have the frequency of the incident radiation. And then we have this constant polarizability. And then we have alpha prime. And alpha prime is now a short or abbreviation for the derivative of the polarizability with respect to Q. And then we have the vibrational amplitude and then the cosine function for the vibrational frequency. So this is the expression for the time-dependent dipole, induced dipole moment. And this comes from the Taylor expansion. Okay, so that's what we did. And this is what we get. And so this we can see that this if we multiply these, we will have something simple, but then we have this cosine times cosine, and we can manipulate this function by using this trigonometric identity. Cosine a times cosine b is this expression, and I'm not going to do it here, but you have a demo exercise on this, so you will go through this yourself. And when you use this identity for this formula here, this is what we get. So the time-dependent dipole is equal to this term, and then this term, and this term. And we have the phase factor still here. And when we multiply these, we get this expression. So you see that what already on this first line here, we have a oscillating term. So we have cosine with omega. So this is incident frequency. And then we have a second term where we have omega plus omega v. Remember, this is incident frequency. This is a vibrational frequency. So this is a sum of frequencies. And then in this term, we have omega minus omega v. So this is a difference between the frequencies. So altogether, we have three different frequencies, frequency components here. And now if we write this a bit differently so that we give this a name omega plus omega v, that is omega, capital omega, we call it AS. So this term is equal to this one here. And then this minus term is equal to omega s. And this AS comes from the name anti-Stokes. We call this anti-Stokes. And this S comes from the name Stokes. We call this radiation Stokes radiation. And we have here this constant polarizability. And then we have this called Raman polarizability, which is equal to this expression from here. So it's a vibrational amplitude and the derivative of the polarizability with respect to vibrational coordinate. That is important. I will show you soon. So now I write this again here. And let's investigate these terms. The first term is frequency component of induced dipole moment that has the same frequency as incident radiation. And the amplitude, which comes from the electric field amplitude times the constant polarizability. And this is Rayleigh scattering. It describes Rayleigh scattering having the same frequency as the incident radiation. Then we have a second term, which has amplitude E0 alpha Raman. And now this radiation, this component of induced dipole has frequency which is omega plus omega v. So it is higher frequency than incident radiation. This is called anti-Stokes. And then we have the third term, where we have the omega s, which is a Stokes frequency, and that is omega minus omega v. So this has a lower frequency than the incident radiation. So this theory tells us that when we radiate, irradiate molecules that vibrate with the radiation with the frequency omega, we will get scattered light. And in this scattered light, we will have the same frequency as incident radiation, and we will have two new frequencies, and these are the sums and differences of the incident radiation with the vibrational frequency. And that tells us that if we analyze this radiation, we measure by spectrometer, we can deduce the vibrational frequencies. So this gives us method for measuring vibrational frequencies, which is different from the infrared spectroscopy. So this is a scattering technique, and this is a basis for Raman scattering. Now this expression is for the single vibration. Now when we have a complicated molecule which has many vibrations, all vibrations can be considered as individual oscillators, and then all of them will give similar terms. And then the total scattering will consist of all frequency components coming from different vibrations. So altogether, this gives a basis for measuring vibrational spectra for molecules with a light scattering technique. So now we come back to this Raman polarizability. And you can see that if this Raman polarizability is zero, then we will not see Raman scattering. We will only see Rayleigh scattering. And if you remember what the Raman scattering, Raman polarization is, it is a derivative of polarizability with respect to vibrational coordinate. So that is a selection rule. But that makes a lot of sense, because if the polarizability does not change with vibration, then of course this will not modify our incident radiation. We will come back to this later on this course, this polarizability and dependence on vibrational coordinate, but that is something to keep in mind, that this is a selection rule for Raman scattering, that the polarizability must change with the vibrational coordinate. And it turns out that, especially for symmetrical molecules, not all vibrations give a change of polarizability with the vibration. Okay, now, what is, so this is, this actually gives you very nicely the positions or the frequencies of the Raman scattered radiation. And remember, this is purely classical theory, but it fails in one aspect. It predicts that the intensity of anti-Stokes radiation and Stokes radiation is the same. Both have the same amplitude, but in reality, the anti-Stokes radiation will be much weaker, and it requires population of excited vibrational state, and we need to consider this Boltzmann population, and there, that is where the this simple theory does not properly describe this intensity. Now, a couple of perhaps details about scattering is that this Rayleigh scattering, it affects all the molecules in the radiation field similarly. So basically, the scattered radiation from all molecules will have a definite phase relationship. So it's they will have the same phase or fixed phase relationship between different molecules. And that is something which it's different from Raman. I will put this. Just a second. Yes. So for Raman scattering, this is not the case. I will come back to that soon. But that leads to a certain effect. Namely, if you take, for example, a fairly strong laser beam and you make it propagate in air, and if your laser beam is strong enough, you will see the beam in the air. And that is because of Rayleigh scattering. So you will observe scattered light and then you will see the beam. Now, you would then imagine that if you put your beam to propagate in a solid material like a crystal, it should be tremendously stronger, this scattering, because the density of molecules is about a factor of 1,000 higher in a crystal than in a gas. But that is not the case. So if you put your radiation in a crystalline material, solid material, typically the Rayleigh scattering is very weak. And that is may seem strange. But that has an explanation in this phase relationship. Namely, in a periodic crystal, your molecules are well ordered. And when the radiation wave propagates, it will generate all the molecules, will generate Rayleigh radiation, and they are in phase locked, or basically the phases are the same. And I cannot show it here very well, but just have to believe me that when you have such an ordered array of molecules and all of them act as sources of secondary radiation with the definite phase relationship, there will be a destructive interference between these individual waves. And altogether, this destructive interference will attenuate this radiation. It will only survive in a forward direction so that light can propagate, but in a transverse direction, it will not generate Rayleigh scattering because of this interference effect, which occurs because of this phase relation between waves from different molecules. And you need some kind of inhomogeneities or fluctuations. So if there are inhomogeneities in the matter, then you will break partially this destructive interference and you will see scattering. But that is an explanation of this effect, that why it is very weak, from why laser can propagate in these materials without huge Rayleigh scattering. Now, in Raman scattering, different molecules have different vibrational phases, so they are not phase related, and there is no coherent summing or interference. And thus the Raman signal is basically sum of individual molecule signals. And therefore the Raman signal, it increases linearly with the number of molecules. So that is very good, because it means that it's linearly proportional to the number of molecules. And basically it's also then good for analytical techniques that you can actually measure the concentrations of molecules from the Raman signal. Okay, so this is all. Excuse me. See you next time.